Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here today for our interview episode with Rebecca Ford.
Hi, Katie.
Rebecca, we're both here to have interviews that we did to talk about because we're getting into the heat of Emmy season and there are lots of people to talk about. So we have two interviews on this week's episode, which is very exciting. And the first one we'll hear is you talking to Elle Fanning, who is the lead of two big shows and is pretty great in both of them, I hear.
She is great in both The Great and The Girl from Plainville. I mean, it's interesting because Elle hadn't led a television show until she started The Great. And now she has two this season with season two of The Great and The Girl from Plainville. And I feel like she's just really shining on television in these lead roles. So, yeah, it was definitely great to hear about the experiences. And she shot them 2 weeks apart. So Whoa. She only had 2 weeks to transition from Catherine the Great to Michelle Carter.
Yeah, I have not caught up with The Girl from Plainville yet, but it is part of what we've discussed as kind of a big true crime murder, I guess not quite murder in this situation, part of this big boom we're having now. But it sounds like she may be what makes that show really stand out from the pack.
Yeah, I mean, for those who don't know, it's a true story about a young woman who basically encourages her boyfriend to commit suicide, which he does. And then she ends up going to trial for sort of orchestrating this through text messages. So it was a really fascinating case when it came out, but they really are able to sort of dig into why she may have done this and sort of this reality she lived in. You know, she really romanticized shows like Glee and the movie The Fault in Our Stars and sort of these like dramatic tragedies. And so that kind of helps explain it, but it really is Elle's performance that is really stunning because she has to, it's a very demanding role and she really pulls it off and she really transforms. She looks a lot like Michelle Carter. You kind of forget it's Elle Fanning.
Yeah, and I should recommend to anyone who's interested in the Glee aspect of it that our colleague Savannah Walsh wrote a piece a few weeks ago about Michelle Carter's obsession with Glee and kind of had that show's strange legacy, which is not what I expected to be part of the story, so that's worth reading as well. But for now, let's listen to your conversation with Elle Fanning.
So I'm so excited to welcome Elle Fanning to the podcast today. She's the star of both The Great, which just aired its season two, and The Girl from Plainville, which has just wrapped up its finale on Hulu. I would love to start with what this was like filming these two things, how much time you had between the two of them and sort of how you pull off that kind of transition.
Yes, well, I only had 2 weeks in between. True, you know, my fashion, I'm always hopping from one thing to the next very quickly. And I'd really been living, you know, in Catherine's world for so long. So it was a real shock to the system, I would say. I was a little bit nervous myself. I'm like, am I going to be able to do this? But I actually think it turned out to be a good thing, because if I went to like another comedy, I would just be trying to recreate, you know, some of the spark that we had from the great. So going to something really different and something I hadn't done in a long time, because I hadn't really done a true kind of intense drama in a while. So yeah, only 2 weeks. It's wild.
It's interesting because The Great was basically the first show you really signed on to, a first television series. And I'm curious, now that it has become such a success and it does take up a lot of your time, what has been the challenge of that? Do you feel like you're able to still sign on to the films you want to do? Is it all just kind of a bigger balancing act for you now?
Yeah, I mean, obviously with shows, you do have to be, you know, you have to carve out, it's more of a commitment. So it's 6 months, basically, like minimum of a commitment. So you really have to love it to be able to want to sign on, or, you know, potentially have to give up movies or other smaller things that literally, like, you know, indies could take as like 4 weeks. So it's like, oh, you can do fit so many little films in there. But yeah, ultimately you just have to be okay with that decision. And so far I have been, like, I feel like these shows have given me a challenge that no movies that I've come across lately have held, you know. I mean, these characters kind of couldn't be better in that sense, for challenging me. So gosh, I know. I mean, the world, like, it's also so odd now with films and TV and just like the blurred lines of that, and how a lot of movies people are like, well, is it on streaming? It's like, oh, it's not. Oh, I'm not going to watch it. Like, this is crazy. Like, just trying to navigate. I'm like, what is the next step? What is the right way to look at choosing a role now? You know, do you care about if people see it? Do you want to just challenge yourself for the part? Is it about the story? Like, I mean, it's always been a gut reaction for me. So I try to just go by that feeling of you don't want to give it up, and you feel like you know, you want to work with that director, or want to work with those actors, or that's kind of the same motto that I live by with how to choose stuff. But it's interesting. I mean, there's just so, I don't know, for me at least at this time, it was like the opportunities in the TV world were so perfect that I was fine with the long commitment.
And obviously season two, this character, Catherine, is in a very different place. She's taking power. She's pregnant. She's also mourning the loss of a lover. And I'm curious, was it more challenging to sort of get in this place rather than the narrative of the first season where she's like trying to come to power, I guess?
Yeah, I think the first season, the arc was really like A to B and really fleshed out. And you could, you know, you could see, okay, it's kind of naive young girls thrown into a crazy situation, and she has to figure out a plan of, you know, how to get out of that. And so the growth of her character in the first season was something that I was familiar with, was something that I could really wrap my head around. And then, you know, after finishing the first season, I'm like, what is Tony going to come up with? You know, I don't think it can't be again, her just getting, you know, becoming a woman and being strong. Like, okay, what's he going to do now? And knowing, obviously, I knew in the first season, but that Catherine would be pregnant, it's like, that's something I can really latch on to. Also in the comedy sense of playing with the physicality of the pregnancy and the growing bump. And I also became, I think, well, through both of these parts, but especially with Catherine, I can feel, like, I felt like my acting muscle, wherever that is or whatever that is or how stupid it sounds, but like, it really grew and became less embarrassed. Like, I really have become a little bit more uninhibited. I'm a very uninhibited person, but, you know, you can't, you're, when you're on camera, you're like, you're conscious. I mean, you have to not be. And I think with Catherine, it's helped me to become so unconscious of what's going on and just going for the bizarre choice, or really going for the harder choice. I think that Catherine's such a juxtaposition of her emotions are so wildly different at so many times. And she has this insane ego that, like, she's really kind of, you know, she really thinks highly of herself, especially in the second season. And that was interesting to play with, of someone who's so hungry for the power, But then when they get the power, are they really going to be able to succeed? Are, you know, I think I wanted the audience to even question if Catherine was the right, you know, person for the job. And that's something that she's grappling with herself and trying to become a mother to the country and being a mother herself. I didn't, you know, the whole pregnancy thing, and I felt like Catherine isn't a very maternal person. So I was very aware of not like touching my bump too much, because I also feel like when people, I don't know, when I've seen, you know, films and sometimes people touch the bump a lot, I'm like, oh, it looks fake. So I was trying to like not be aware of it until the scene called for me to like acknowledge, but I wouldn't like rest my hands there too often. I was definitely aware of that, but gosh, yeah, that added a whole other dimension of, which was fun to play with. Cause I think that's what our show does so well. It's like, we always cut, I mean, the high stakes and the drama are very real. Like, we have to live in the truth of the emotion. And when things are hurtful or, you know, dangerous, they truly are dangerous in our show. And we all believe that. But then sometimes those intense moments are cut with a real comic beat or something, you know, and it's just like, it sums it up, like having like a, you know, political conversation while I'm like eating dirt and sucking on nails and like, you know, it's kind of, you have to just wrap your head around that and be able to do both and believe both fully for the show to work. And I think we really found our stride in the second season. Everyone really came to play like even more, like knowing the first season's tone and being comfortable with that, we were all just ready to go at it. And we'd been in quarantine, so we were like, let's party! Like, we can only party with each other, so let's do this.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So I do want to shift to Girl from Plainville. You know, we're talking after the finale has aired, but I want to kind of go back. And for those who haven't seen it, the Hulu series is about Michelle Carter, who was convicted of involuntary manslaughter for basically encouraging her boyfriend to commit suicide. It's a true story. And Elle plays Michelle. And I'm curious for you, I think with a story like this, everyone wants to know just what was going on inside her head. And you sort of have the responsibility of figuring that out. So how did you approach that?
Yeah, that's, you know, that's kind of, I guess, the question of the hour with, you know, there's so many shows like this as like lately that we've seen. And it's so, I think, so telling of our fascination with these stories. And I think our fascination with seeing the behind the scenes, you know, when we, you know, these news stories that are so well known to, you know, we see them on the news or flashed across, you know, the headlines. And that was same with me. I mean, I think I was 18, 19 when the trial was happening. So I was probably, you know, I wasn't following every detail of this, but I definitely remember seeing those paparazzi photos of her and, you know, just being aware of the case and also being aware of how modern this case was, because it could only have happened kind of in this generation with how we so rely on our phones and technology and that connection of false intimacy that we're all still trying to navigate. So I was aware of that. Obviously they were around my same age, so you're aware of that, but just how kind of one-dimensional the media paints these stories. And I think on both sides, it's like Michelle was very much the black widow and manipulator, and I don't have to agree with the things she did, but you also have to, in order to play a character, you have to understand how she got there, you know? How was she able to say the things she did and the process of that? And then on the other side, you know, Conrad, he was very one-dimensional as well. He was kind of this victim. We didn't learn about his backstory or who he was as a young man. And when they came to me with this story or wanting to, you know, possibly turn into a show, I was like apprehensive. Like, I was like, I don't know if I should do this. Does anyone need this retold? Just because, you know, these families are still alive. A life was lost. It could really be, the really bad version of this could really be awful. And since, you know, trying to romanticize this or sensationalizing it, and just, I definitely wasn't interested in that. And I think, you know, I got to be a producer on that, and being able to actually, even though, you know, there's a greater responsibility when you are both in it and a producer, but I think being more involved and having more of a say gave me a little bit more comfort to know that it would be in the hands of people that I trust and friends of mine. And we were kind of all doing this and share the same hope for the show, and that it's just this, it's a very unbiased telling. We're not trying to rewrite what happened. I mean, she was convicted, and that is the truth of that. But at the same time, really bringing awareness to what young people are going through today. And with Michelle, at some point, you have to separate yourself from the real person. You know, there, of course, there's the physicality, and you know, you want to try to look as accurately like the person on the outside. And people are very much aware of what she, you know, especially in the courtroom, looked like. And I watched a lot of the courtroom and things like that. But at a certain point, I separated myself from kind of who she was, because honestly, I didn't talk to her. I don't know who she exactly is. You know, there's not a lot of footage of her. And so as an actor, you kind of have to create your own trajectory, or you're not going to be able to tell the story. So in my viewpoint, what really got me in there was her obsession with Glee and The Fault in Our Stars, and kind of that YA world and living in fantasy, and like the blurred lines that we all kind of have with between like fantasy and reality. Because I live in fantasy land, like I'm an actor, so I'm very much aware of that. That feeling sometimes you can get caught up in stories and make believe. And to me, that was when I kind of saw an understanding. And if someone, these two people who were very, you know, they were very lonely and reaching out to one another. I mean, we had access to a lot of things, to all the texts, which we read, and very, very intense to read, but also filled with teenage silliness and a full relationship, but they only met a handful of times. So it was so intriguing. I mean, I think the balance of calculating her at each moment was something I'd never, you have a responsibility because these people are alive, but then also just as from a character perspective of the high drama that she has a lot of the time was something that I was very aware of and wanted to show, but then was also slightly worried that people would think that Elle, the actor, was like being overly dramatic or hysteric. And I'm like, oh, are they gonna get that? Is this gonna come across, or is it just gonna look like really bad acting? Which, you know, I don't know how to describe, but it was towing that line every day of how far to push it and how far to not.
It totally makes sense. And I think it works really well in the show. And one of the things I thought was really smart was how when the pair are texting, the show made it so it looks like two characters are talking to each other, because no one wants to just like read text on a screen in a television show. But I'm curious, for you as an actor, was that ever difficult to do because you're reading text sort of to each other, but acting opposite each other at the same time?
Well, I thought the same thing. Even when, you know, when this show was presented, I hadn't really read the scripts yet. I'm like, but how is this going to be cinematic? Like, texting is so boring. Like, if I have to watch another show with people texting or the bubbles popping up, like, I'm like, I can't do that. I don't, that's not filmmaking to me. It's just not, you know, something we live every day. I think a lot of the time when it's something we experience every day, we don't want to watch it. You know, I don't want to watch people in masks or like a pandemic show. That's for sure. Not, you know, the new thing. So I was pleasantly surprised when they had kind of come up with this device of having us both in the rooms and together. And the text messages were all, you know, really lifted from their real messages. So knowing that also helps you to know, well, this is based in fact, because it's really their conversations they had. But we had guidelines, like we had rules in those scenes where we weren't allowed to touch each other. And a lot of the time, Colton and I, he's just so good. Colton's fantastic, and so happy that we got to have him. But he, both of us were kind of calculating this thing, because he'd be playing one emotion, I'd be playing another, or interpreting his words in a different way. And we would really like experiment with that in those scenes, because like text, you know, a lot of the time something you're trying to say, someone's, you know, interpreting it differently. And so we would play with that when we were, we even played with possibly like not looking at each other, but I think we ended up, that was a little step too far. We did look in each other's eyes, but I think we would test out different things, what would work best.
It definitely captures how many miscommunications there are over text. Like, it's just so relatable because it happens to everyone. And I want to talk a little bit about the finale without super spoiling anything, although I think most people know how her story sort of ends. But there's a really interesting sort of fantasy element to the way it ends, and sort of wondering what her life could have been like if things had gone differently. And I'm curious how that choice came about, and why you feel like that really worked to end the show.
We talked a lot about what episode 8 was going to be, because it's just, how do you end this story? You don't want to tie a ribbon around it and kind of neatly package it away, because that's not what happened. But then also you have to kind of put an end to it somehow. And I think because our show played with these fantasy moments, we kind of sprinkled it throughout with the, you know, the Glee musical, and we have the Teenage Dirtbag in 7 at the end. And it just seemed fitting. There was kind of no other way to get inside of Michelle's head. I think that's what we tried to do, is that she's kind of stuck in this world that she can't get out of until she kind of faces what she did and what she's done, and kind of face the guilt that she's been carrying with her. And, you know, because also we didn't want to, there would have been another way of trying to show the phone call or show what happened that night. And that just did not feel, that didn't feel right, because no one was there. We don't know. We weren't interested in trying to imagine that, because, you know, we don't have records of what that was. So I think kind of going inside of, you know, she lives in such a fantasy world so much of the time. And so to be able to kind of take a step back and do that. And, you know, in the pub bar that, like, where we meet, there was a lot, all these Easter eggs kind of throughout of that the set designer had put in of, it kind of felt very like Michelle Gondry, like in a way, you know, we Colton and I, we felt like we were in, like, I don't know, Eternal Sunshine or something, like, you know, and, you know, kind of committing to that, but also, yeah, just kind of taking a step back and kind of seeing what is in there for a moment, and seeing her possibly, you know, regret the decision that she made, and lives with till this day. You know, I also think I love the shot of, like, both of, I mean, it's very on the nose, but I think it sums it up of, like, both the phones going in. And they're the weapons in our show. You know, we don't have a weapon, but the phones really are. So in this case, so I also really like that shot. But there was really no other way. I think we had to kind of culminate it in this fantasy, because we didn't want to come up with something and make it, well, this is what happened, you know, because that's also really dangerous to do. Because, you know, we didn't want to do that.
Yeah. And the interesting thing I noticed in this show, when the verdict is read, and then in The Great, it happens every once in a while, but especially when Catherine finds out about what Peter did to her mom, there's these close-up shots on your face, which is like, they work so well, but I can imagine as an actor, they're not the easiest thing to pull off because you have to show so much emotion. And I'm curious how you approach those moments because directors seem to love to do it to you. So you're very good at it.
That is so funny because I never thought about that, but it is, now I'm thinking, I'm like, cameras are always really, really close to my face. It's like, you can't make any sudden movements. You're like, gonna hit. I know, well, Liz was calling, because Liz directed that episode, she was calling that like the Silence of the Lambs shot, you know, like right up in there. I wonder why. I don't know. It's like these impactful moments. When, yeah, like you said, it's like the most emotional moments. They're like, let's get up in there and see. So you're like, okay, pressure's on. Like, camera's right. I'm literally looking basically into the lens. It's just like, you know, you and the camera. I remember that day for Plainville, you kind of have to drown everything out when you're doing, I mean, in general, you do for those scenes, but when the camera's with you, it's like there's nothing else around, and I really get into a zone. I remember, I think people like that day were like singing like full-on songs like in the back, and like Liz was like, what are they doing? Like, people are like, she's like, this is crazy, but I don't even remember that. Like, I just, you have to put such blinders on and you're just like in this trance with the camera. So I kind of enjoy those moments. I'm like, all right, let's go. Let's do this.
And you sort of mentioned this when we started talking, but I'm curious for you how you sort of view these two roles. Do they have something in common for what they've allowed you to do as an actor? You're saying they sort of allowed you to stretch and be challenged, but in, you know, in 10 years, how do you think you'll look at these two roles?
I think that they mark a really special moment in my career or working life. Like, I think they just do. I mean, it's really interesting too, though, as, you know, people are seeing me more as like an adult, you know, adult actor or whatever, because I started working so young. But then I'm also like, well, in Plainville, I'm playing like a high schooler, but still there's something about it that they're not viewing me in the way of the child. And I think, and I was thinking about this, because I think when you're a child acting, like those roles are very, like, they're kind of designed to be observant. And I was very conscious of that when I was younger, and I was kind of envious of the other actors that I would work with, because their roles would be, you know, the parents or whoever it is, they're always the people doing the thing. They're doing something and they're getting to be wild and experiment. But then the child in the scene is kind of the one that's like, weirdly, like kind of knows better, or like is the eyes through it. Like, and so you're kind of, which is it's an exercise, because I'm like, wow, I've really learned to kind of capture that knowing, you know, just like observing quality. But I'm like, when am I going to be able to be the one being observed? I want to be observed doing the crazy stuff. And I think these two roles have allowed me to kind of step out of being that observant and getting to take action in a real way and take action in my career and just take hold of that. And so, yeah, they've marked, I mean, I think there might, I don't know, they're extremely special, and like, hope everything feels like this, but I am aware that it's a real unique feeling.
And so I know the show The Great has been renewed. Are you already reading scripts or shooting, or where are you in the process for season 3?
Yes, we start filming in May. So we're about to go back to London, and I've read one script, the first one, because he writes it as he goes on. But we also had like a pitch out meeting the other day, and he explains the whole season. I'm like, can't believe I'm going to be jumping back into that. Playing, you know, I haven't played a character for so long. I don't know. I've never done. I mean, I guess with Maleficent, I came back to it years later. But this is just really, she's growing at the same rate I am, Catherine. I'm like, it's a really cool experience.
I was getting a little worried because I know the show is not based in fact, but in history, you know, Peter doesn't last much longer in this story, but I can't imagine you not acting opposite Nicholas Holt. So
me either. I'm getting worried too. I was worried last year because Tony never really would say what was going to happen. I mean, we knew that Nick was saved to the last episode, but still it's like, what are you going to do? Like, he can't die. I'm like, it's Nick. Like, what do you mean? Like, he's like, you know, my partner in crime on this show. It's like, he's makes this show. He's so incredible. So I don't know. I mean, now he plays Pugachev, right? So there's that. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, Tony, he'll come up with something. I know, I'm worried.
Okay, so now for our second interview, we're going to hear me talking to Wumi Mosaku, who is a real standout among many standouts on the new HBO series We Own This City, which is from David Simon, famously of The Wire. And I started watching the show on your recommendation, Rebecca, and, you know, you kind of agreed with me that she was a standout from it. John Bernthal is kind of the big, maybe, like, flashiest performance at the center of it as this cop who you kind of watch getting corrupted by the system of Baltimore police. But Wumi Mosaku, who you might also know from Lovecraft Country and also from Loki, she's had a pretty incredible couple of years, plays kind of more of the audience surrogate. She's this woman who's come from the Department of Justice. She's trying to investigate what's going on there and is going around kind of like a classic detective story, asking questions, trying to get to the bottom of something. And what really stood out for me, and I, you may have noticed this too, Rebecca, like she's got this warmth to her. Even when she's asking like really functional, exposition-heavy questions, you kind of feel the real person in there. And I was so excited to talk to her in real life and witness some of that for myself. Is that something you've seen, you've noticed too, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think that role could have been really dry and sort of boring if in the hands of the wrong actress. So I'm really excited you get to talk to her because I feel like she brings so many layers to it that, you know, probably weren't on the page.
Yeah. And I felt that way, too, about her performance in Loki as Hunter B-15, you know, this kind of big, flashy sci-fi show and Tom Hiddleston doing his charismatic Loki thing in the middle of it. And she really brought a lot to that character, too. So I was really excited to talk to her. Let's hear my interview with Wumi Mosaku. Okay, so I'm here with Wumi Mosaku. It's such a pleasure to have you here because I devoured the first three episodes of We Own This City in a way I didn't expect because it's heavy material. And I think you watch it and you're like, am I ready for this? And then it sucks you in the way that so many David Simon shows have done before. And you're part in this show. You know, we're only going to talk about the first three episodes, so I don't know where your character is headed. But it's this really complex show, and you, in some ways, are the audience surrogate. You're kind of the person who comes in and asks the questions and, like, tries to set things straight. And that's a challenging role in a lot of ways. But the challenge that I kind of want to know about first is just diving into something that's this complicated and this rich and where you start from to play one piece of a show that's thorough.
The way I approached Nicole, because she very much feels like the audience going through this story, finding out this story in real time. I felt like that when I was reading the script. Mm-hmm. I was reading it and thinking, what happened? When? Where? Who were these people? And I would go back and forth between, like, you know, Wikipedia and Google and, you know, newspaper clippings. And a lot of the questions that I was asking myself, or well, asking, Nicole was asking, and a lot of the things I was feeling about this whole, the whole system, Nicole was feeling. Mm-hmm. She felt to me like the audience in the piece. That's how I approached her and felt really natural and you know, really honest, normal questions someone might ask and think and feel when faced with this idea of, like, who holds power? What do they do with this power? Mm-hmm. Who's safe from these people with power? Who's not safe? That's how I approached her. It felt very, she felt very honest. Her opinions, her feelings, her responses felt very honest and genuine.
I think in the first episode, it feels to me like something of a thesis for the character where Nicole is greeting a new colleague and he's like, how does this not make you mad? And you say as Nicole, like, it does, but I try not to make that part of it. And I feel like what I'm watching after that is, you know, you're saying that she's very honest and says what she thinks, but she's also kind of dividing herself in some ways and trying not to let it pull her down. And is that a tension that you keep in mind as you develop this character over the course of the show?
Yeah, I feel like that's a really, again, genuine tension that I feel a lot of people walk around with on a day to day. The kind of needing to get things done, needing to live your life, needing to feel joy and peace, but also needing to confront the things that are oppressive, confront oppression, and violence and inequality and all the things that are oppressive. I do feel like that is what we do.
Yeah, it's being a person, not just doing this kind of job. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of actors take research for a character as kind of like a chance to go back to school. Like you get to dig into something and learn about something you didn't know about. When you jump into something like that, is that how it felt to you? Was it kind of like going back to school to learn about police in Baltimore and what a consent decree is, which I didn't know and had to look up? Do you relish that level of research on this or anything else?
Oh yeah. I mean, it just, you have to understand all the things that made the character who they are from the moment you meet them. Right. So you kind of, you work backwards, you know, what does it take to become a lawyer in the civil rights division? What is the civil rights division of the Justice Department?
Yeah.
What are these departments, especially for someone like me who's coming from the UK? It's like learning, trying to understand the whole, how the whole system works. But then at the same time, you can get quite distracted by, you know, going too far in, because you can find out if she played the guitar. But also, you can work that, you can make that up. But also, for someone like me who's really new to the whole country and how everything works, I had to keep it quite streamlined and, like, yes, figuring out what a consent decree is and seeing the final product and what it meant to in Baltimore, learning about Baltimore as a city, learning about systemic inequalities and the systems that are in place.
I mean, you've worked with at least two veterans of The Wire that I can count, with Idris Elba on Luther and then on the late Michael K. Williams on Lovecraft Country. Was The Wire or anything, any of this David Simon world, was that familiar to you? Did it loom large for you in any way before doing the show?
I hadn't watched The Wire. I had started it in 2009, but I didn't have like a TV where you can record things and rewind, and I couldn't understand the accents and stuff. And,
oh, people watch it with subtitles. So many people do.
Right. So I didn't have any of that available to me. So I stopped watching in 2009 because I just couldn't. I don't think I got past episode one because I just didn't understand what was going on. Then I actually started watching it last year just because it's my husband's favorite show. Like, he's watched it all the way through 5 times. And I don't think that 5th time will be his last time. And, you know, it's the greatest TV of all time, TV show of all time. Apparently, that's what people say.
Yeah.
And so I had decided to start watching it. And then I got the audition. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to stop because I feel like I can get quite intimidated and feel inferior and have, what was it called, imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to meet David and George and Nina as equal as I felt like I could, like as in not, you know, idolizing them as gods, as demigods, you know, and so I could meet them in that environment as honestly as I could as people.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I did, because I restarted it again, actually, last week before last. And it is amazing. And they are brilliant. And now I watch it with love for them as people and the creatives behind it as well. Because a lot of the Wire cast and crew were on the show.
Yeah.
And this feeling of family and community and loving Baltimore as well. Now I watch it with a different like reverence, a more like a more connected reverence rather than like a these creative gods, you know, like.
I feel like that's so much of the power of the show, too, is The Wire, like We Own the City, is so complicated and has so much about systems and, you know, the way that a society works. But the people, the characters, you just care about in such a deep way. And it feels like people, you know, I still think about Stringer Bell as a person 15 years after watching the show. And I think that's the power of this kind of storytelling, that you feel so connected to it. That's so fun that you get to connect to it as like a viewer, having like lived it, sort of. I don't know if it feels like that to you.
You know, I do. People keep saying like Wire 2.0, and I'm like, The Wire 2.0. I'm like, I don't feel like it's, I think even David might have said that too. I feel like because it's based on truth, it hits me completely differently, because I didn't know what had happened in 2017. I had no idea. And The Wire is a drama, an amazing piece of fictional TV. And that kind of artistry is one thing. And then there's this. This is like real life with real consequences and real repercussions. And people are still dealing with the fallout of even being in that city, whether or not they connected directly with these cops. The city of Baltimore is changed because of the level of corruption that was in the BPD. It's quite extraordinary to me just to see the scars and wounds on a city. And I don't want to trivialize it or compare it to a drama, because it's because the wounds and the scars are real and aren't even healed.
You had this really long career in Britain, you know, graduated from Rodden, did a lot of television there. But you married an American. And I wonder if this leap to America was partly part of your career. You know, you went to BAFTA and kind of get bigger opportunities. Or was it, did you move here for love? Did you move here for work? Was it a combination of the two? Did it feel like a natural step forward for you?
You know, it's really, it's really interesting because, I had just met my husband a few months before I won the BAFTA. I was in the States for a couple months for pilot season, like every other actor. And then I won a BAFTA. And I was like, wow. But then I met this guy and I was like, ugh. So I moved to the States with a lot of trepidation about my career, because here I am starting again when things have just started to feel like they were getting good in the UK. So it was definitely for love. Like, I think if I was thinking logically about my career, I would have thought I would need to stay in the UK because this is, something's happening right now.
Yeah.
And actually I moved here and then continued working in the UK for like a year. Like I moved here and then I got Luther.
So it was a horrible commute.
It was a terrible commute. My husband got me that job. He was my reading partner on that scene, so we say. And then I came back when I finished Luther, and then I got another job in Wales. I got through the gates, so I went back for that. And then I came back, and then I got his house back in England, and then I got Lovecraft Country.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to kind of work here. But then I still had another job in the UK that I had to go back for, and then Lovecraft went to series. And yeah, it was a long commute.
Well, even with Loki, like, you're working with Tom Hiddleston, who you'd known since college. So it's like, it's still all connected back to London.
To the UK. So true.
I mean, obviously, when you move cities, you have to rebuild relationships, and that's part of it. But do the TV industries and the movie industries feel distinctly different in terms of what work you have to do or what you get to do or how you make your way through it?
Again, I feel really lucky because our director on Lovecraft episode one, who did the pilot, was Jan Demange, British. And then our director on Loki was British. So I feel like they had seen my work. So I felt like when I would come for pilot season, I absolutely felt like a newbie. No one knows any of my work. Nothing had ever really been out in the US. So I felt really new and like I was starting from scratch. However, I did have people who had seen my work who would happen to be working in the States. So like Kate Heron and Jan Demange, they had seen some of my work. So I actually felt very, very lucky that they were on those teams, and because they could vouch, they had a little bit of trust in me, and I wasn't completely coming in without the 14 years prior.
Yeah, the work that you had done translated over, which is important.
Yeah, I did feel very lucky about that.
Yeah. I mean, you've talked in other interviews about Lovecraft Country being a really transformative experience in a lot of ways with who you're working with and working for a Black director. And I wonder how that show ending was so sudden for so many of us, because it had such a huge impact in its one season. And I wonder how you cope with that, and if it made you kind of think differently about investing in a TV show that can get canceled after a season, or working in America. Did it throw you off in any way in moving forward in your career?
Not really. I think in the UK, hardly anything I've done has been like, season after season.
True.
Vera is the only thing I can think of. Luther, I came in for a season of Luther. But yeah, I'm used to things not going again. I'm used to it being like it and over. I'm actually not used to going back to something a year, 2 years later. But it doesn't, I think I'm very like flexible. I always think blessed are the flexible, for they never lose their shape. That is something I try and hold on to, and like, you know, something else will come, something else will happen, and to appreciate it for what it was, and really not take it for granted when you're in it, because you don't know if it's going to be the end or if it's if it's a one season thing. Yeah, I try and hold on to the idea that something will come, and try and stay calm about it and not hold on too tight to an idea, because then those expectations lead to disappointments.
Yeah.
So I do try and like let it go.
Well, I think actors talk a lot about how, you know, there's only so much control you have over where the next job's going to come from and if it's going to be any good. And I would imagine that at this point, you know, you're building off of these things. You know, Lovecraft can lead you to something bigger. Like, do you feel like you have more at least control over what you can choose and jumping on a ship that feels right than maybe you did 10 years ago?
Definitely don't feel like I have more control. I don't know if anyone feels like they have control.
Yeah.
Unless maybe they write and produce themselves, and maybe you would feel like you would have a little bit of control there. But I feel very lucky. I feel lucky that, you know, someone had written a part that played towards my strengths and I was cast in that. I feel like if someone didn't write that part or they wrote them differently, it would have been for someone else, you know? And so I feel like I always just think of myself as like floating in a very big lake, and the deeper the water, as scary as it feels, actually the more likely you are to be, you're going to be held up by, you know, with the deeper the water. And so sometimes you want to fight and control, and actually if you try and fight, you'll just exhaust yourself.
Uh-huh.
And so I try and just imagine myself, I really do think this a lot, like just me floating on a lake. Don't fight it, because you'll just lose.
Well, you mentioned, you know, people who write and produce things themselves earlier. Like, is that something that interests you, or is it all acting for you?
Oh, it does interest me. It scares me, though. It does scare me. I feel like, I don't know, I feel like the ability to write different voices is amazing. It's like, to me, it's like playing the drums, like, different limbs, different rhythms, different, you know, sounds. I'm like, oh, each character has a different voice and a different objective and rhythm. So I really do admire it. I would love to.
When you were in acting school, was there like a, you know, I don't know how much anyone sets out a path for themselves, because like we're saying, as an actor, it can sometimes be out of your control. But did you have a sense of what you wanted or what you thought would happen? And has where your career has gone lined up with that?
Oh, no. My career is nothing like I imagined it would be. I didn't grow up seeing a lot of people who looked like me of my, even my African descent. I, you know, we had a couple of shows with a very, you know, Caribbean family, you know, families and dynamics, but nothing I lived felt represented on screen. And then I guess I kind of fell into acting because my mom was busy and she put me in an acting class on a Saturday because it was the only time she puts all out of the house so she could get the house cleaned and da-da-da-da-da. And so I really fell in love with it, but I guess my first love was really theater. And when I found out about drama school, I didn't even know drama school existed until it was time to go to university. And I panicked and I was like, I don't want to do maths and economics. I don't want to do it. I think I want to act.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my sister and I went through the whole cast of Annie, which is still my favorite film, and heard about RADA because Sir Albert Finney went to RADA. And then we were like, okay, so I'll apply for RADA. And I thankfully got in. And I really thought I really went in thinking, okay, I want to be the most demanded Shakespearean actress of the stage one day. That was my hope and dream. And I also thought I would go to the Royal Academy of Music afterwards and do opera and maybe be an opera singer. I mean, it was always stage. So this has been a really, you know, I haven't felt prepared for any of this in one respect because it wasn't part of my plan. But then because of the nature of our job and, you know, you start off with one line here, two lines here, five lines here, and then you get to character number five and then your character number one and it's like wow, there is a build-up so that you do feel slightly prepared for it in a way, especially when it comes when you start off slow, you know, and start off like for the marathon of it. But yes, it wasn't part of my plan to be on TV. I didn't see it happening. I didn't feel like, you know, I felt like everyone on TV looked like a certain way and was commercial and this and that. And I felt like I wasn't. So, and in fact, I think I was told many times I wasn't. And so this has been a really sweet surprise.
Do you get to feel the impact of what that representation means that now you are on TV for people who didn't think that someone who looked like them would be on TV? Do you get that level of feedback from viewers or anybody else?
You do, actually. And sometimes I take it as like, oh, this is my job. And I take it for granted of what it means to someone else. And I feel that. I feel the importance of it. Someone with my hair texture, with my skin tone, with the, you know, my West African, well, not even just West, my African gap in my teeth and, you know, my full figure. I feel like it matters, but it doesn't just matter for those who want to be an actor. I remember a kid coming up to me after seeing a show and saying that they wanted to be a lawyer. After seeing Damalola, Our Loved Boy, they wanted to be a lawyer. I didn't play a lawyer, but that show mattered so much to them. And it was based on a true life story of a tragedy that happened in Peckham, London, and I played his mother, and that's the role I won the BAFTA for. Mm. And this young kid just like, I want to be a lawyer. I'm like, wow, because of this TV show. Like, so this, I just think art opening people's eyes to cultures and problems and issues and love and can inspire someone to do something else, think something else, feel something else. It doesn't even necessarily have to be in line with what I'm doing in it. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure We Own This City will inspire someone to join the conversation about what are the police here for? Who are they here for? And what can we do to make sure that they're here for everyone? I'm sure that conversation will come up somewhere. And maybe that this will inspire someone to be a lawyer or, I don't know, or politician. I don't know. But representation of all things matter, of life matters, of the breadth and depth of humanity matters. And then you don't know what will come forth from that.
That does it for today's interview episode. We'll be back on Thursday with our usual roundtable conversation. In the meantime, you can find more on all of this spring's big TV shows at VF.com. Follow us on Twitter at Little Gold Men, or sign up to text with us at subtext. Join subtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 718-550-2059. This week's episode, as always, was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.